Good evening. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. This is tape 353. It's September the 8th, 1978. The House Select Committee on Assassinations is having their public hearing on television. They had James Earl Ray last week, and we discussed that. And they're having their hearings on the John Kennedy assassination. They begin out here in California at 6 in the morning, and I have gotten up two mornings. I'll be getting up for every hearing, of course. And the format is that I'm typing up the hearings each day. Yesterday I typed up 90 pages of the testimony of John Connally and Robert Groden, and then I transcribed them into a brief summary of my opinions of that particular day's testimony, the pertinent points, the points left out, the best I could. And I guess I'll keep that format going each day so that I don't get behind. And I typed up the testimony the following day of Dr. Cyril Wecht and the medical testimony on the John Kennedy autopsy and the discrepancies in the Warren Commission report and the autopsy report and the new information that's being put out at this time. There are a lot of questions that you will probably have. Many people that take these tapes are old researchers. They have a lot of material. They know a lot of facts. And they want new information or my opinions on certain areas specifically. And there are many people that have started subscribing to the tapes recently that are not familiar with many years of past work or the 15 years research. And it's very hard to find a compromise here between going into this material at a too fast a point or level and yet informing those people that are not familiar with all the backlog. The only way I can see to do that is to just briefly cover the material that I think is pertinent, and I can't begin to cover it all. I mean, we could do tapes the rest of the year on just what I heard today, I think, or yesterday. But the main thing is that if you have any questions that I don't cover in this material now or on any other tape or any other subject, write to me and I'll do cassettes for you so that we can all share it and update some information. Or you can pick up a telephone and call me. I can't answer letters. I'm just deluged with mail to answer specific points of the research, and that's really difficult and time-consuming. So you can pick up a phone. My number is here on the paper that's enclosed with your tapes. If you have a question to ask, and if you want me to go at length on a subject, just let me know, and if I haven't covered it, I will. The crux of the investigation was put very well by Dr. Cyril Wecht when he testified, it was September the 7th, 1978, on the single bullet theory. Robert Blakey, who I've accused of covering up right from the very beginning, hired a group of nine doctors, forensic pathologists, to give testimony on the bullet direction and the bullet 399 to lean heavily on what is known to the various researchers as the single bullet theory. And they asked Dr. Cyril Wecht, who's both a lawyer and a doctor and a very active, very, very active person continuously in exposing corruption at the highest levels, they asked him to testify before this committee. He testified before the Rockefeller Committee several years ago, and I understand that when they printed their report, they published something different than what he testified. And when he asked for the original report, he couldn't see the original testimony and compare how it was changed. Dr. Cyril Wecht was asked to testify on ballistic trajectory and the autopsy reports because he is a prominent man, but they stacked up these various people against him and let one gentleman, one doctor from New York City, be the spokesman for all the other people, and he would be the person that, by weight of sheer numbers of people against Dr. Cyril Wecht, hopefully Mr. Blakey, Robert Blakey, hoped that they would soften what Cyril Wecht had to say. And Dr. Baden was the man speaking for all the other pathologists. But as he wound up his testimony and argued continuously about the what is known as a single bullet theory, it's the thing which the Warren Commission clung to. It was created by Arlene Specter. It has no ability to hold up in terms of trajectory or evidence, physical evidence. It's something that people cling to because they have to hold on to the lone assassin story. When you get into two or more gunmen, you have a conspiracy. And Dr. Cyril Wecht was very moving and very dramatic, and these tapes are available at the Tape Center here in Pacific Grove. You can write to me, and I'll include the address here. You can get any or all of these tapes. And I think in terms of research, you should at least get the tape of Dr. Cyril Weck, the last hour that he testified or so before he completed his testimony, because he got very angry when they tried to nail him with being outnumbered by the other people, and he gave logical reasons why he thought his testimony would hold up. And he made an important point that when assassination happens in the future, whether it's a president or a congressman or a judge, a federal government, a figure, that the medical examination and the legal investigation should be done in a way that is proper, that any ordinary citizen gets, that the average person gets, and the physical evidence shouldn't be destroyed. And if we had a clear record of physical evidence in these assassinations, and if we also had prosecution for people who destroy evidence in criminal matters, it would be harder to do these conspiracies because there would be less chance of people knowing that they can get away with it. And he asked that the record show for all times that there is a way to conduct autopsies and legal investigations. He also said that there's a mental block, an impediment. And he said he recognizes this. It's a political nature. It prevents individuals from letting it all come out. He as much as said there is a conspiracy. If you want to see it, it's all there. And they asked him how come he sees it and the other men don't, and he said, because I'm more open. He attacked the way that the autopsy was done years ago. We have all objected to that. We researchers, some of us started 15 years ago when we read the Warren Commission exhibits and testimony, and only this week they changed the bullets. The fatal headshot from John Kennedy is now officially 4 inches higher than it was before. These people worked with a photograph, and Commander Hume worked with the actual body. So there shouldn't be a discrepancy of more than a half an inch. Even though Commander Hume didn't have photographs, he had the corpse on the table. And yet there's a 4-inch difference and a lot of bungling, and he wasn't cross-examined on any of this. But Dr. Cyril Weck said the reason he sees it differently, that he lets it come out. And I could identify with that. The reason I think I see history differently and could see it changing and sees the lies and corruption all along is that I'm not afraid of truth, and I'm not afraid of some people being hurt, because for all of those that get hurt and caught, there's others that will be saved in the future. And I don't think it's negative to look for conspiracies. I think it's positive. And I identify with a life force of wanting to do a thorough job so it doesn't happen again, and so that people don't get away with these things and are allowed free on the streets to do other assassinations and murders. He said that if they show up the single bullet theory, if they would give it up, it has no basis ballistically, trajectory-wise, it witnesses photographic evidence. There isn't anything to support the fact that one bullet came out of Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle and went into the back of John Kennedy and out the throat and into the back of John Connally and through his chest and broke ribs and into his lungs and into his hand and shattered the wrist and then went into his thigh and fell out whole and pristine on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital. And he said, when you give that up, when you give up that, then you get into an area of criminal conspiracy. And the reason people are holding on to the single bullet theory and they can't go into two or more is you have a criminal conspiracy. And he said, this recognition is hard for people to see. Cyril Wecht went on and said, the president is gone. We can't bring him back. But we have political assassinations all over the world. He said there was a coup d'etat. We consider them in, he named the countries of Europe and Asia, the banana republics, Africa, Orient, everywhere, but not the USA. And he went on to say it did happen here. And he said, I don't know who it was or how it happened, but there was this coup d'etat and that people are afraid to face it. And as long as they hold on to the single bullet theory, they'll never solve the assassination. It was a very dramatic moment, and I was excited because he did talk about people's fears of holding on, of political interests, vested political interests. He said that several of the doctors that opposed his views, one worked for CBS, one worked for the Rockefeller Committee, that they had political reasons for bowing under and tantamount to being black, not blackmailed, but just playing the game, politically, medically, playing the game. And they asked him several times, is this what you mean? And he said yes. And I was really excited. There's very few heroes in this whole game of research. There's a lot of really good people that I know that I could name who never would be allowed to testify before the committee any more than they would let me testify there. So they, even with their careful screening job of making sure that you went through these layers of people and were screened, Cyril Wecht got through, said what he had to say, and the record will be printed, and you can buy it from the government printing office, and you can buy the tapes and be proud that after 15 years, somebody can speak up and tell it like it is decently. And he made a lot of points, and I was really very happy to identify with him and with my work that I've done against tremendous odds. We've done it against tremendous odds. But the truth will come out, and in spite of Blakey's covering up and the way the committee is set up, it will make a mark, and there will be more investigations because it's just going to open new areas of bungling that these people have done even while they spent their $5 million. The committee hearings are running about 7 hours a day continuously with very little break. And my sending you a tape just once a week won't cover many, many hours of work. So, as I say, I have to condense my summary of some of this. But the first hearings on the John Kennedy assassination began with John Connally and Mrs. Connally. And, of course, they give a lot of credence to what they're saying, particularly when they say that Lee Harvey Oswald, they believe all the shots came from the direction of Lee Harvey Oswald, that they came behind us. John Connally said there was no other direction. It had to be from behind him. He heard two shots. His wife heard three shots, but it isn't important for their sake. They just simply stated flatly that it came from behind them. They never mentioned silencers. I have a book here on silencers built for the CIA. They were made for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Gary Powers had a gun with a silencer when he was brought down over the Soviet Union. Mr. Werbel, who made them for the anti-Castro Cubans and the White House plumbers, built silencers. And the consideration that these bullets could come, be more of them, a flurry of bullets, like Mr. Kellerman said in the Secret Service, never comes up at all. And the fact that many bullets, shells could be on the grass or picked up later or in the seat of the car or in the body of the car, this is never brought up. They simply stick with the recall of John and Nellie Connally that there were two or three shots. Of course, there was a man named Mr. Teague who was shot. A bullet went to the curb and ricocheted and hurt him, and his cheek was bleeding. So if Mrs. Connally is right that one shot killed John Kennedy, shot John Kennedy's back and throat, and another shot went through John Connally, and then the fatal headshot to John Kennedy, then there is the bullet that hit Mr. Teague, and that's four bullets, and that makes a conspiracy right there. If you accept Nellie Connally's testimony, she's putting a conspiracy right on their lap, and then they have to write a report to get around that. The Connallys were interesting. There were comments by the committee. There were three main issues which the committee stated. Mr. Stokes was running the panel. They have the mandate to find out who killed John Kennedy, did federal agencies perform adequately before or after, and did the assassin or assassins have assistance? Now, they're not going to answer any three of these questions because of the way they're made up. That's their mandate, but they will skirt around them and cover. And we, as I say, we'll have another 15 or 20-year bout before we get another committee. They began their hearings by relying, like the Warren Report did, on how thorough they were. This time, they had 40 investigators, 564 points of interest, 1,897 days of travel, 75 witnesses in executive session. It looks puny compared to the Warren Report. The Warren Report statistics were massive. But the main thing is that the Warren Report was never, ever duplicated. It was supposed to be the most thorough investigation that was ever done by the federal government. And yet a day after the hearings opened, we heard Commander Hume, who did the autopsy on John Kennedy, say how physically exhausted he was, and he was tired. And his first autopsy report had blood all over it, so he had to destroy it. And he didn't have photographs to work with like this committee has. And if he did, he'd see that the entry bullet wound was 4 inches above where he gave the autopsy. Commander Hume didn't have photographs. They were available, and all they had to do was develop them. They could have been developed instantly, and there were autopsy x-rays that could have been developed instead of waiting 2 or 3 years to get at those to see if there were bullet fragments when he wrote his report. But also, he had the body there. And what he wrote in his report of the body entry bullet was 4 inches different than this report, which is kind of interesting. So the statistics don't mean anything. If you're going to fumble the information, you could have 3,000 investigators and spend $72 million and still not come up with the right report. The commentator on the radio KQED was always making little digs. He always assumes that Lee Harvey Oswald was the person who shot the rifle. And there were little remarks always, such as, every avenue is being pursued. This was one of the quotations. And another cover-up for the Warren Report was that information will come out that the Warren Report didn't have access to because of scientific techniques in 1964. That may be true, that there are a few they didn't have, but the Warren Report was corrupt. As I said on KGO this week, about the week before it was ever put together, it was corrupted. There's another statement that was on the air. If all the information were made available that the FBI and the CIA have, then the entire truth would be known. That's a lie. It can't all be available because much of it must be destroyed. Richard Helms destroyed presidential papers. President Nixon told him not to destroy records of mind control program, and he destroyed them the day before he became ambassador to Iran. So why would you think that they would keep this information? The brains of John Kennedy have been destroyed. They're nowhere around, and Cyril Wecht had been looking for them as a pathologist. So we can't decide that truth lies with documents that the CIA or FBI have somewhere in the archives. I think we could get the truth if we all sat down and combined our research now. The answers would be very easy to put together. Another thing you hear on the news media in the break on KQED is that some people will never be satisfied. They will see conspiracies in anything. That isn't true. If we got the documentation and evidence that is required to come to a conclusion, then we'd be satisfied. They also said on television, Paul Hawk was there saying that they had to eliminate the crazies because they come in all shapes and sizes. He was referring to people like Penn Jones, Bob Cutler, myself, Sherman Skolnick, and many of the researchers. I can mention many, many of them that never were allowed to even get a letter to the commission and the committee back there. And they think that by calling people irresponsible and screening them out, that they have a sanitized, absolutely accurate investigation. Yet when they keep all the crazies away and they manage to keep all of us from ever getting near the committee, they're still shown as not running the proper ballistic tests, as padding the evidence, not calling the right witnesses on the stand, and certainly not asking the right questions when the limits that witnesses are there. One of the big problems is that the committee will blame some dead people for the report. Probably they'll say, inasmuch as we never know. One of them is Mr. Miltier. His name came up because he had made a tape recording 2 weeks before John Kennedy was killed, that John Kennedy would be killed in Miami, and that an assassin would use a gun that was put together, could be put together in the building, a high-powered scope, and that there would be a patsy to take the blame. Mr. Miltier is dead, but the Warren Commission had that tape recording, and he was alive at the time. And also there's a Mr. Chrisman who was shown, his picture was shown on the screen, and he was one of the men with the well-known Tramps picture. Chrisman was an important far-right winger. He's from the Seattle area, and was leading these tramps away from Dealey Plaza. They weren't arrested or fingerprinted. And Chrisman is dead. And instead of going after people like Carlos Marcello or Eugene Brading, organized crime figures that I'm sure Robert Blakey knows very well through his contacts with Mo Dalitz, if there is to be any blame at all, they can say, well, Alan Dulles is dead, and Earl Warren is dead, and Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, and Jack Ruby, and 129 or 30 other people. So there's some things we'll never know. But they could get people like Carlos Marcello and see his relationship to David Ferry and Eugene Brading. Congressman Stokes began the hearings in his holier-than-thou, nauseating voice, saying, our mandate requires us to examine all the facts and circumstances surrounding the assassination. Now, it'd be more reasonable if he said, hey, look, folks, this is a thing that's going on for 15 years. There's 150 books on the subject. There are categories that are so long and broad that we will never be able to go into them, such as the killing of Officer Tippit, or the Oswald doubles, or Jack Ruby killing Lee Harvey Oswald, or the shooting of General Walker. To say we are going to examine all the facts and circumstances is to make you think that they're doing just that, but it's absolutely, it's physically impossible to do that. And Mr. Stokes is sort of a black Adolf Hitler standing there and telling you a big lie, and a big lie you might accept. He said, we will evaluate all the evidence. We're willing to listen to all the facts and circumstances, and we'll examine the material, and we will listen to reasonable persons. Now, the reasonable is the catchphrase. You see, if there's a lock on the door and Sherman Skolnick can't talk about the assassination plans to kill John Kennedy in Chicago, just a week before the assassination plans to kill John Kennedy in Miami, and 3 weeks before Kennedy was killed in Dallas, we're in a really bad way. See, Skolnick has the information about the Chicago plans, but he isn't considered reasonable. Mark Lane had made a speech that Mae Brussel and Penn Jones and Sherman Skolnick would never get before the committee, and I've mentioned that before on the tapes. So reasonable is the key word. It's used twice. Once they said this committee came into existence because of critics, writers, and researchers acting reasonably. This is Robert Blakey. To act irresponsibly is to mention Nazis and George de Morenschild or Martin Bormann, or the allegations of the links of Richard Nixon's office to the extreme right wing that could be involved in the assassination, and the German military men that came from Munich, Germany, to General Walker's friends in the Southwest, Robert Morris. That is irresponsibility to make those connections. So what they were saying on the television is, we'll listen to reasonable persons. And there were many reasonable persons they still didn't listen to. Jeremiah Leary was one of the men on KQED. He's one of the moderators that stays on there and talks before and after and during the show, during the break. Jeremiah Leary has constantly put down any research on the assassinations and never seen a conspiracy. He works for the Washington Star that was recently bought by the New York Times. The New York Times published the first Warren Report. And we have to watch Jeremiah Leary say, this is the trial that Lee Harvey Oswald never received. And then the commission gets together. I keep calling the commission, the committee gets together and says, keep in mind, this is not a trial. There's no cross-examination. There's no defendant. There's no prosecution. We just are examining the facts. But these words are like a spot mind-washing or brainwashing. In other words, what I'm saying to you, I have typed up from the hearings the first day, and I'm repeating some of the stuff that comes over the air that must stay in your mind like a Camel Soup ad. Every avenue's pursued. The Warren Commission didn't have this information. We can't know until the FBI and the CIA declassify material. People would never be satisfied. The crazies had to be eliminated, and so forth. And then we will listen to reasonable people. And then Jeremiah Leary says, this is the trial that Lee Harvey Oswald never received, which again is another lie. Idi Amin compares himself to Adolf Hitler. He loves Hitler. And I think Mr. Stokes and Fontre must be our American Adolf Hitler. So when I watch them up there on the rostrum. Interesting enough, the hearings, it's a little nauseating, begin by saying, this is KQED, and this program is given to you under the auspices of the Ford Foundation. And then I shudder because I think of when they talk about the Ford Foundation, I wonder why the Fords just don't give enough money for some of the basic tests we need in this case, instead of sanitizing a committee and putting for the American people once and for all these doubts are supposed to be tucked into security blankets and your doubts put to rest. So they're not asking for donations on KQED. It's a listener-sponsored station here. They did that during the Senate Select Committee. They asked people to send in money. But this time, we don't have to spend money. We just sit back, and the Ford Foundation does it. Now, the Ford Foundation, the Ford Motor Company, has the car that John Kennedy was riding in when he was killed. I mentioned before that I was told by a source who was familiar with the Secret Service, who cooked for the presidents and their wives, and was familiar, used to exchange champagne with the Secret Service for information. And he told me that an agent told him that in the metal part of the car, under the upholstery, where bullets had gone through, that they would find evidence of that flurry of bullets that Mr. Kellerman talked about. Again, it would have to be with silencers, and that could explain one of the bullets in the wrist of John Connally, or a second headshot from the front that Cyril Weck talked about in John Kennedy's case. The Ford Motor Company has this car. Within 48 hours after the time John Kennedy was killed, it was taken to Dearborn, Michigan, and Cincinnati, I believe, and the interior was ripped out, and it was used until recently by the presidents. But because Mr. Kellerman talked about a flurry of bullets, and he sat in the front seat of the car and said he knows ballistics very well, and they never considered silencers used by the CIA or the Bay of Pigs operation, and they never took pictures of the car interior before it was rebuilt, it would be nice and impossible that this particular committee would just take that car and bring it down to Washington and strip everything out and see if there were any markings on it. Now, that isn't so far out when you consider that John Connally's clothing was destroyed by dry cleaning so we couldn't see if there were entry bullets. The street sign that was in Abraham Zapruder's film, the famous one where John Kennedy just crosses through that sign and he's clutching his throat, that sign was removed the day of the assassination and has never been seen since. And it's not like John Kennedy's brains where somebody asked to see the brains. I don't think anybody has asked or ever seen the road sign, and it could have bullet nicks in it from a silencer. The lamppost also was removed from in front of the Texas School Book Depository, which is a pretty funny thing to do right after the assassination. And these things would indicate that maybe there was even just one extra bullet out by a silencer that did one of these shots and fell or nicked this sign on the way in. The reason I think Ford is important, and I've mentioned it once before, was that at the time that Lee Oswald was at work in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, he was working at Leslie Welding in Fort Worth, a Lawrence Orloff went to visit Marina Oswald with George de Morenschild. Now, there was an Alexander Orloff who worked with the Central Intelligence Agency, and there was another Orloff that worked with Henry Ford, helping to publish the Prodigals of Elders of Zion, this important document that was given to the Nazis in Western Europe to say that the Jews were trying to take over the world. Dearborn, Michigan, and Detroit, Michigan were centers of some of the worst anti-Semitism and fascism coming out of this country. And it's interesting because the Warren Commission, of course, never checked out if the George de Morenschild, Lawrence Orloff connections knew Ford at all or were related to the Orloff that was up at the Ford Motor Company. But the car of John Kennedy is up there, and of course we hear on the program this hearing is coming to you from the Ford Foundation, and I wonder, it's nice that they're putting that on, but I just assume they put a little money into shipping the car back to Washington where it can be ripped out again and examined. There also is the conclusion by Robert Blakey's testimony, John Connally's testimony, and Jeremiah Leary from the Washington Star continuously that John Kennedy was, the suggestion that he was responsible for his own death. They kept making snide remarks such as John Kennedy had said, anybody who comes to a tall building with a scope could kill you, you couldn't be protected. Well, that's not true. A man with a scope in a tall building in Miami was about to kill John Kennedy, and somebody reported it and taped it, and it was stopped. John Kennedy's under the assumption that if you have no Secret Service work, of course they can do it, but he should think that with foreign dignitaries getting people in tall buildings and in windows and covering windows from the streets looking at them to see if anybody was there who would be shooting, I'm sure that when he made the remark, he meant if you didn't have protection. But they kept repeating that first day, the fact that, well, we never could protect a president if an individual wants to kill him. Now, they never say if there's a conspiracy and they want to kill him. As a matter of fact, Jeremiah Leary made a remark that he said, well, even that little girl or kind of a thing, aspersion on Squeaky Fromm, if she could shoot a gun better, she would have got Gerald Ford. The question isn't whether or not Squeaky could pull a gun fast enough. The question is, how did a member of the Manson family, dressed like Red Riding Hood with a red hood and those tennis shoes, freaky looking to begin with, get that close to the President of the United States when every other person has areas cordoned off? When Gerald Ford comes here to play golf, you can't get a car to go down the freeway for miles. Every access to Pebble Beach is closed off, and it's just impossible to get within 2 or 3 feet of Gerald Ford, much less to be one of the original members of the Manson family. And then John and Mrs. Connally kept saying over and over and reiterating that it was only because Kennedy wanted to come to Texas that they let him, that he was really a nuisance and he wasn't popular and he wasn't really wanted there, his position, I guess, on civil rights and so forth, and he kept pressuring it. So they finally said, the commission said, was there a time where you had to give in to his request to be there? That Kennedy just insisted that he's coming to Texas. So reluctantly, John Connally said, well, I'll do the best I can and give you these parties, and they make John Kennedy responsible for his own death instead of going into the Lawson testimony on the terrible Secret Service protection that John Kennedy had at the time of his death. They make him seem to be responsible for it, and this is the work of Robert Blakey's commission and all the members. On the other side of this tape, I'm going to go into Robert Groden's testimony because I was very impressed with it. The evidence and pictures and documents that Robert Groden presented are the foot in the door that will keep the question of the assassinations going for at least another 20 years, and the fact that he presented it gets us started on a new era of public exposure.